tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tiny in All That Air, the Philip Larkin Society Podcast. My name is Lynn Lockwood and I'm the Deputy Chair of the Society. This episode is all about the two PLS conference events that took place on the 13th to the 15th of March at the University of Hull this year. I had originally planned to do some recording during the 3 days with attendees and speakers on the spot, as it were, but in the end there was just too much happening for me to fit all that in. So I've caught up with a few people who have very generously been in touch to talk about what they enjoyed and the relationship with Larkin and Hull. Professor Douglas Bell, now back home in the city of Ningbo in China, reflects on visiting Hull City Centre and Cottenham for the first time in over 30 years, having graduated from the University of Hull in 1991. Rachel Gallant-Lee, PLS trustee, merchandise officer and friend to the podcast, talks about speakers David Quantick, Blake Morrison, Adam Lomax, our actors Daniel Wayne and Lynn Harrison, and the contribution made by our wonderful artist DJ Roberts. Helen Cooper reflects on her research into Larkin, Lucian Freud and cancel culture, as well as the allure of Larkin bookends. And Lucy Keating gives us her view of Larkin as someone who has also worked for many years in academic libraries, as well as being a fan of classic English pop music. We end with Professor Graham Chesters, our chair, and his thoughts about not just the main conference, but also the schools and colleges post-16 Education Day that we also held that week, with an amazing story about a very special pair of letters, one written to Larkin and one written by Larkin in response. So how long had it been since you'd been in Hull when you came over to the conference?
Oh, good Lord. About 30, depending how you count it, 35 or 37 years. So we could go in the middle and say 36, but it was the end of the 80s. I graduated formally in 91, so that would be definitely the last time I was in Hull. So however many years that is, it's a while ago.
You saw all the changes to Hull. I hope it's positive, though.
A mixed bag, if I'm honest. I mean, all the people of the good folk of Hull who are listening to this podcast, I get banned from coming back. I thought there were some positives, but I felt some areas were looking a bit sad. I felt, you know, some of the shops had closed. I think I said in the opening to my talk at the conference, I was surprised to find Marks and Spencer's was no more, and a few other sort of shops were looking a bit tatty. I felt a bit of an economic downturn in some parts of the city, so that was a change. The university still looked much as ever. The university hadn't really changed that much. New signage on the buildings, obviously the Larkin building. Back in my day was the art building. That was my building. You know, I did all my studying in there. Library had changed a bit on the inside when I went in for the tour. Lots of changes, but it was great to go back and to sort of have a wander around and see my old haunts.
Did you get back up to Cottenham?
I did. Yes, I made a point of going to Cottenham deliberately on the Sunday. I went to pay my respects to Larkin's grave, as you know, the last time I'd been there would have probably been 91. So I definitely wanted to do that. And of course, Monica's there now and Maeve's there as well. So that was particularly poignant for me to go out and sort of revisit that. And going back to Cottingham was sort of bittersweet in some ways, because being there as a student, I'd spent my first 2 years living in Cottingham. I lived in what were then big student houses on Thwaite Street. And of course, those have now been sold off. So the sort of student village that used to be Cottingham back in the 80s when I was there is no more. I never saw a single student when I was there at the weekend. The Lawns has seemingly been closed down. That used to be a really massive hub. And Cottingham Village Centre was very quiet. So I'm sure Cottingham must have felt the economic backlash from not having however many thousand students it used to be. So it seemed very quiet, and it was a bit strange, a bit of a ghost town, I felt, Cottingham, compared to how it used to be.
That's interesting. We used to have our AGMs at the Lawns.
All right.
Because it's a great, great building, a great place to go with all the trees and the fields.
Yeah. Cottingham still has that sort of Larkin feel to it. I mean, it was nice for me to go back to Cottingham and sort of see some of the places that still resonate with Larkin. I mean, Holtby House, you know, I'd spent a brief time in Holtby House myself, although that used to be the postgraduate accommodation, and lots of international students got billeted in Holtby House. But I hadn't realised, I think it was when I read, it was either Andrew Motion's biography or James's, that Larkin himself had lived in Holtby House for a period. And he'd lived on Hallgate as well in Cottingham for a period. So it was very interesting, you know, a few Sundays ago to have a walk around and look at some of these places with fresh eyes, as it were, not older eyes, and just have that sense of history again, you know.
What did you learn at the conference, and what was your, what were the things that you enjoyed or just kind of
I've got to gush about it. I enjoyed everything. There was nothing I didn't enjoy. I mean, everything. What I particularly liked about it, if I compare that conference, your conference, that genre of conference, if you like, with the ones that I usually attend in my discipline, I liked the diversity. It wasn't just academic papers. You know, you had the music, you had the drama, you had the sort of Philip Larkin little skit that was put on. You know, you had stuff that was looking at Larkin's connection with art, the doodles at the end, you know, the talk about that. I felt you had a really good balance of different facets, you know. The sort of academic conferences that I more typically go to, they're all academic. You know, you wouldn't get an arts performance, a music performance. You'd just get professors like myself talking about their research. And you had that in the conference. You know, you had some pretty high-level academic stuff going on, but you also had some more accessible, sort of enjoyable, more social stuff going on. And I thought that was great, and that's a really nice to see that balance of you know, I was inspired. I mean, I'd love to go back. I'll go back to your next conference, I hope.
I'm not an academic, so I have attended a few academic conferences, but I'm not part of that world, so I wouldn't know how to organise one. So this is my version of an academic conference where the focus is on engaging people and enjoying ourselves, really.
It's what I particularly liked. I mean, you know, as you know, I gave a paper, a public professorial address about Philip Larkin here. And the difference, I suppose, between those two venues, you know, when I was doing my talk here, I was pretty sure that 90% of my audience didn't know very much about Larkin, or that they maybe just had a bit of knowledge about Larkin, and they were coming hopefully to learn a bit more from me. The big difference, of course, attending your conference is that probably it's the other way around. There's about probably 95% of the people in there, if not more, are Larkin experts in one way or another, and they will know everything that you're talking about. So that makes it, in some ways, as a speaker at that conference, more challenging, because you're talking to a very well-educated audience about Larkin. And, you know, you might say something and then people would say, well, no, I disagree with you there. Oh, you've got that wrong, or you've misquoted that. You know, you're talking to a very well-informed audience.
I wouldn't say 95% of the audience are experts. I think actually it's talking to people there. There are a lot of people that came that actually would say, I don't actually know much about Philip Larkin. I must have
talked to different people. Because for me, the reason I said 95%, because the dinner night I was talking to various people, and it was giving me heebie-jeebies about my talk on the Friday morning, because I thought, oh, Christ, I better go back and bone up on my slides here, because, you know, everyone I'm talking to seems to know an awful lot about Larkin. And I was thinking, ooh, maybe my talk is going to be too lightweight. You know, I made that comment to a few people. I said, I might have to go back and rejig it, you know.
What the actors brought, again, was quite robust, like, you know, interpretation of Larkin's life, and which led to some quite interesting conversations.
I felt that I spoke to both of the actors there on the night of the dinner. You know, we had a good natter about that, and I thought they did a great job. But I said to them, you know, I thought they also had a very difficult job, particularly when you've got some people in the audience who knew Maeve and knew Betty, and, you know,
Yeah.
That, to me, if I was thinking myself into their shoes, the actor's shoes, I mean, that would worry me a bit, because I think, you know, I'm portraying someone that these guys know, and, you know, they might violently disagree with the way that I'm portraying them, or I might have got it wrong, you know. And I did wonder that myself, you know. I thought, ooh, you know, there's aspects coming out that don't entirely match with my own sort of, I think I said this, I've forgotten the lady's name who did the Maeve acting, but I said, you know, my sort of image, I never met Maeve, I didn't know Maeve, but my image of her from listening to her in interviews and reading about her and reading letters and all of that was maybe a little bit different to the way that she was portrayed in that skit. I would have said, I think I said as much to the actor, I would have identified that more with Betty, who I also had never met or knew anything about, but she seemed more Betty-esque to me in the sort of robustness. She was quite robust in the skit. That's the word. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah, quite feisty, quite, you know, able to stand up for herself. I never had that sort of impression as strongly about Maeve. Not to say that she was, you know, a mouse or something, but I just didn't have that same image. So that gave me pause for thought. And that was great. You know, that's the whole point of things, isn't it? To make you think. Yeah.
That's it. It's an Lynn, there you go. And, your name's Lynn, yeah. She was called the actress. She was great. Yeah, she was great in how she explained that interpretation and, you know, the confidence that she came with that. Because, I was actually the same. I couldn't imagine what it must be like watching actors portray some of my friends on stage, you know, maybe quite a long time after they passed away as well, and seeing these people trying to portray their life on stage. It must be very strange for Carol.
Yeah, I spoke
James
to Carol,
that knew them.
Lovely lady. I mean, I spoke to Carol briefly a couple of times, someone I'd have liked to have talked more to, and obviously I spoke to James. But we talked about that. I said, gosh, it must be very strange for you, for someone who actually knows the people here, you know, that your friends or were your friends, and you're seeing this portrayal of them. And I think Carol said, you know, she says, we'd had the same reaction, you know. So challenging anyway, but all strength to Lynn and Daniel, I think was his name, right? Yeah, I'm trying to remember the names.
Yeah.
All strength to them for, you know, they did a good job. The acting was great, you know. So,
Yeah, it was really good. And Carol and James were so generous in their time and in their support of everything that we did. And I went up to the cemetery at Cottenham as well and took some flowers up on my way home on the Friday afternoon, because I always like to go and just apologise for all the things that we do in their names. We haven't offended the three of them.
It's a strange place, that cemetery. Yeah. I mean, I was telling a few people, so apologies if I'm telling you again, but when I very first went there in 1987, before there was any Larkin Trail, before there was any hype, if you like, around Larkin, I'd only heard sort of a rumour that Larkin was buried in Cottingham. And because I was living in Cottingham as a student, I thought, oh, I'll go and find his grave. And, you know, it was a bit of a sort of a detective work thing, because there was no internet. I couldn't sort of Google find a grave. I just had this rough idea that, well, I'd heard he's in Cottingham, so where would he be? And I looked in St. Mary's Churchyard near where I was living, and he wasn't there. And I thought, well, where's the main cemetery? And, okay, found where the cemetery was. And I just went along on spec. And I can remember it was a sort of a sunny Saturday morning, and I walked miles. It's quite a long way off the cemetery, you know, if you're walking from the outskirts of Cottingham. And as I was going, I thought, I'll never find him. You know, it's going to be like a scene from The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. You know, I'm going into this massive graveyard looking for a grave, and I'll be there all day. I'll never find him. And it wasn't like that at all. I walked in, and it was really quite uncanny. I went straight, literally, I'm not exaggerating, I went straight to the spot. It was just like I was guided. You know, I walked in, and I thought, I think he's over here. And sure enough, I went straight to it. And it really, at the time, it really upset me. I remember tearing up. You know, I'm whatever I was, 18-year-old undergraduate, you know, boys don't cry sort of thing. But I remember tearing up when I stood at the grave, just at the sort of plainness of it, you know, and the fact that all the other graves have got something on, like, you know, much loved grandfather or dearly missed husband. And when you look at Larkin's grave, you know, it's Philip Larkin, 1922, 1985, writer. That's it. And I remember that really upsetting me and sort of having a chat with him, if you like, about that and really feeling a sense of, ooh. And I revisited that, you know, a few weeks ago when I went back, that feeling of, But tempered with the knowledge, as I say, that he's got Monica just a few rows over and Maeve a few rows over to the other side. So they're sort of all together.
And Monica's grave is very similar in style and appearance.
Yes.
To Muckins, which I find quite moving. It's kind of like a echo of his.
I've had a sort of nascent poem brewing in me about this since the conference. I just haven't had time to sit down and work it out. Work keeps getting in the way. But if I get a quiet moment away from day job demands, I want to try to explore that because there is something poetic there, you know, about the fact that all three of them have ended up fairly close proximity. And the similarities of the graves, and I had all sorts of ideas tumbling around in my head.
Have you got the nerve to say that you don't want me no more? Have you got the nerve to say that you don't?
So we've survived the conference.
Hooray!
You didn't come to the first conference, so was this? What were you expecting when you came up?
Yeah, I was a bit. I felt a bit left out that I couldn't go to the first one.
You weren't allowed.
I weren't allowed. No, I'm afraid. But my job changed, and so yeah, I was really looking forward to this. And thanks, really, for letting me do the bits I really wanted to do.
Yeah,
it's absolutely amazing. So obviously, lots of preparation leading up to the event. I particularly enjoyed my initial meetings with Daniel Wayne and Lynn Harrison and just chatting about Larking with Women and their experiences performing that twice. They were fantastic. Yeah. They were really lovely people to work with. And actually then just seeing that in performance was great.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably one of the highlights for me of the whole conference, just the variety, because we had that production on stage with the Q&A and then the mechanicals were just brilliant. And I think that made it really special and maybe not quite what I was expecting from a kind of academic conference. Mm. So, yeah, that was good.
Yeah, Daniel Wayne's funny because like when he's not being larking, he's about the most unlarking type person. And then I suppose that's what acting is.
Yeah, yes. Testament to what a brilliant actor he is. Yeah. But just such lovely people as well.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, being there as the merchandising officer, it was just brilliant to see DJ's beautiful designs all laid out and just chatting to lots of people who are interested in buying some merch. It's actually a really good opportunity for me to chat to more guests than maybe I would have done.
It was a very chatty couple of days, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think we could have probably just not even had any speakers at one point.
Mm-hmm.
just had a whole hour of people chatting in the morning. It would have been really good.
Yeah, with those delicious sandwiches.
Yeah. Food was great.
It was really great that DJ could join us as well.
Yeah.
So just chatting to him was a particular highlight.
I know.
He's so great. And my friend Nick came along. It was his birthday and he's since become a member. So another one joins the club.
You weren't just doing your preparation with Daniel Wayne and Lynn Harrison. You were wrangling the keynote speakers as well.
Of course. I mean, that was just a massive honour to do the introduction for David Quantick. I mean, yeah, we were all just laughing out loud straight away. What a way to start the conference. I mean, the whole thing was just hilarious. And I was privileged enough to see rough outline of his speech before. But yeah, it was just brilliant. I think Eeyore has a birthday. His reading of that was a highlight. But also his description of Ted Hughes being a biker obsessed with fish. I think in terms of the speakers, I mean, they were all great. They really were. But I think being a music lover and also somebody who was listening to Blur's Modern Life is Rubbish in the mid-90s, Adam Lomax was just outstanding. All those connections that he made between Britpop and Larkin, especially the writing of Jarvis Cocker.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just riveting. Really great.
And he's going to do some more research into that, I think, an article or something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it'd be really good to hear even more. I think he's really wanting to interview Jarvis Cocker, I think.
Yeah.
But it'd be good. I thought somebody like Stuart McConey would be a great.
He would be superb. Yeah. Mm. Put a little message out there and see if Stuart's interested.
Yeah, yeah. No, that would be great to have someone like him along, just a different view. And I think journalists like and writers like David Kontick and Stuart McConey are such good communicators. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what was really good about David Kontick was that he was very good at like writing to the brief and kind of understanding his audience. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a real skill. And when somebody is a professional writer like him and used to having a public reception and being listened to publicly. Yeah. And of course, Blake Morrison.
Yes, of course.
His new collection.
Wonderful. Yeah. Really good. Yeah. Fab. And actually, I've not read Skin and Blister before. And I read that pretty much in one sitting.
Did you?
And I've now lent my sister that collection. And we're going to pick out a few poems that we both really love and get together and read them together.
Oh.
So, yeah. But he was great. He was he's a lovely man.
Yeah.
And he even got a massive round in.
Yeah, I missed that. I've gone home by then. Yeah. I heard about the massive round.
Yeah, so thanks, Blake.
But he was very sociable, wasn't he? He had a really nice time down the pub. He was really good company. Every time I looked round, he was just chatting away to somebody. Mm-hmm. I told him that I thought his Yorkshire accent got stronger when he read his poetry.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah,
it does.
Do you know, also, he brought along some books to sell in the merch stand and we sold out.
Yeah.
We totally sold out.
That's great.
So I do hope we've paid Blake. Yeah. let us know if you haven't received that payment.
Yeah. I asked him to sign my copy of When Did You Last See Your Father?
So did I. Yeah. So did I.
Yeah. Oh, well. He got a lot of love from us all, didn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
That was good.
So I was a bit starstruck, what with Blake and David in one day.
Oh, my God. I was a bit wobbly. Yeah. I was so terrified. I was quite glad that they were on the Thursday. So I think if I'm going to mess up, it will hopefully be on the Friday. And they won't be around to see that.
So well done, missus. Nice work.
Yeah. Looking forward to the next one.
Yeah.
Was when I came up to hear Alan Johnson in conversation with Rosie Millard.
Oh, did you?
Yes, at the Hull Truck Theatre.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I always like coming up to Hull, actually. I used to visit Hull as a teenager because my friend was at university there. So I have some very fond memories of that. And since about 2000 and I don't know, 17, I've visited several times to do research for various projects that I've had on the go.
Yeah, is that up at the History Centre you go to then when you come up for research? Yeah. It was lovely to hear from Claire Weatherall talking about all the items and to have the Larkinalia on the desk. I kept looking over at the typewriter. It was a little bit of give myself a bit of luck. Larkin's lucky typewriter.
One of the highlights for me was being able to buy two of the bookends from the 2017 exhibition that was staged at the Bryn Mawr Jones Library. Yeah, I came up for that exhibition and I really liked the way that was done. So I've got a couple of those now in my living room.
Oh, that's great. What have you got on yours?
I've got one is a doodle and the other one is reference to Larkin starting at King Henry VIII School, Junior School in 1930.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. I might donate it to the school, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, that's really lovely. I got one that they kept coming out. They kept getting kind of replenished, like in a supermarket. And I eventually managed to get one, and it's a doodle of the creature holding a bottle of wine upside down with the last drops coming out, which is perfect for me. So I was really pleased with that one. Graham had been hiding those in his study. I didn't even know he had them.
I should think he's quite glad to get rid of them.
Yeah, very much so, I think. Yeah, very relieved. So your talk about Lucian Freud and Philip Larkin was so interesting, and it's such a an important issue, like how we deal with the legacy of writers that live quite troubled lives, or artists, you know, and musicians obviously as well, being two people that were born in 1922 as well, as a chronological contemporary, even if they didn't really have much to do with each other. How did you find sort of putting that together then and thinking about that?
I found it really interesting because the original impetus was this issue of sort of cancellation culture. Mm. But the more I looked into it, there was far more to it than that in terms of comparing two men and their lives. Mm. And that was really my interest in looking at Larkin compared with Freud, was that there did seem to be a huge difference in the way that society forgave what they regarded as foibles, if you like, whereas they judged Larkin very harshly. I wonder also whether there's an issue to do with how harshly they judged themselves. So I don't think Lucian Freud judged himself harshly. I think he was happier in his own skin, whereas I think Larkin wasn't happy necessarily in his own skin, and therefore perhaps was extremely self-critical and almost handed people the stick to beat him with. Mm.
Yeah, the sort of vulnerabilities or the weaknesses, the cracks in the armour for Philip Larkin, that's interesting. And I guess with Freud, it's the understanding the context of the paintings, because the paintings themselves may not be, you might not be able to interpret from the paintings themselves what was going on in his life unless you actually knew something about his life. Was there any letters of Freud published?
Yes. Yeah. There is an archive. There's a book of letters. There's so much material about both men that it was very difficult to thin that down into a coherent sort of paper. Mm. And so I didn't look in detail at the correspondence of either of them. Mm. But that would be really interesting. I mean, I was going to include the fact that they both illustrated their correspondence in their youth.
Right, yeah.
But I thought that would overlap with Philip Pullen's paper about doodles. Mm. It would be really interesting to have a detailed look and comparison of the correspondence. In preparation for this chat today, I was looking at, you know, doing some reading of sources that I'd looked at, and one of them talks about analysing Freud's work, ironically, because obviously his grandfather was Sigmund Freud, analysing that from a sort of psychoanalytical point of view and looking at transference and projection, and how some people perceive a great deal of anxiety emanating from Freud's paintings in the same way that people perceive that coming from Larkin's poems, and how in a way that can be seen as the artist or the poet projecting their own anxiety onto their subject matter. Mm. And that to me seems like another incredibly rich vein of research to look at that. So they're just two very interesting people who ploughed their own furrows, really.
Yeah.
And obviously the fact that they were born in the same year, they each had these sort of career milestones in 1974 and are both regarded nationally as stars in their own right.
Yeah.
The more I looked into it, the more I found, really.
Yeah, and you were talking about the exhibitions, the Freud exhibitions that don't have any kind of particular trigger warnings, or they don't prepare you for any kind of concerns about what sort of person he was or how he treated his children or all the kind of things that he did that were so pretty terrible from what I learned from your talk. Whereas, you know, we are getting a bit of that with Larkin, institutions sort of distancing themselves from him.
The other interesting difference is Larkin's relationship to his art. So although he took it very seriously, you know, I mean, that's sort of an understatement. Mm. The fact is it was only part of his life, and he took very seriously his role as a librarian at Hull University.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference between him and other writers and artists, I think, that he never entirely relied upon his art as a sort of foundation of his life.
That's really interesting. And Freud was really destined to be a professional artist.
Yes, although he said of himself that he had no natural talent. Mm. And if you compare his juvenilia with Larkin's doodles in his correspondence with his friends, it's clear that Larkin did have some natural artistic talent, and Freud didn't, but Freud clearly just had wanted to be a painter and worked very hard to achieve that.
Yeah, but I'm really looking forward to seeing this book of the doodles, because some of the artwork that Phil and Jim showed, you can really see the latent talent in there.
Yeah.
But then, you know, same with his photography, you sort of feel there was a latent professional photographer there as well.
I really enjoyed the conference. I didn't get to participate in as much as I had wanted because I was still actually writing my paper. But I love the way these Philip Larkin Society conferences bring together people who are interested in Larkin and knowledgeable about Larkin. I always like and enjoy the academic papers because I think they add something that I wouldn't get under my own steam, if you like, because I'm not an English literature academic. I really enjoyed it, and also, you know, just catching up with old friends is always really good.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of catching up and hard to get people back in.
Yes. Well, I think you and your colleagues did an amazing job organising it, so well done.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And hopefully we'll see you in 2 years' time when I've had a good rest.
I've got a soft spot for Hull, I must admit. I'm married to a rugby league fan, so we've made quite a few sporting pilgrimages to Hull. And I came down as well when it was the capital of culture. I went to the Larkin exhibition at the Bryn Mawr Jones Library then, and I combined that with a trip to see my Hull city, and we lost 6-1. So that, but the Larkin exhibition was well worth it. The football match, not so much. But I was thinking, actually, though, the one bit that really felt poignant was the little display of it had a little, very very small and slim pile of his published poetry anthologies, and then completely dwarfed by the huge volumes of library minutes that, you know, and obviously he felt he was more prolific at library minutes than poet, because I worked in academic libraries all my life, so I've always been particularly interested in that side of Larkin's life. So yes, I could identify with that.
is that still a very current genre then in the library world, the library committee meeting minutes?
We do like our committees and subcommittees, yes, and we do tend to be quite bureaucratic, I must say. But in my professional career, I did over the years encounter one or two people who had met Larkin in his professional world, you know, whether chairing meetings or whatever. And they, you know, they all remarked on how impressive and professional he was, that he was renowned for being forward thinking and, you know, very impressive administrator. And I mean, to oversee the building of a new library and a computerization project. I mean, they're two huge projects, and so, you know, it wasn't just something he did to pay the bills. It was a career he obviously took very seriously. What's always amazed me is that he became head librarian at Hull when he was only 32, which is just inconceivable now, you know, to have relatively little experience. So he must have interviewed very well.
Yeah, he was recommended, I think, from Belfast as well. So I think he was very impressive there as a young librarian, and have made a big impact there. Mm-hmm. It seemed wherever he went, he throughout his librarian career, I mean, that's not my profession, obviously, but it seemed like he wanted to come in and you know, take it in hand and make these places really good places to go as a librarian.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, and not, you know, people might think, oh, I bet he was a Luddite and fuddy-duddy, but, you know, not at all. I mean, you know, very pro-computerization, and he had an attention to detail as well. I read that he, you know, he personally interviewed every member of staff and made sure he knew their names, and he, I think he chose the interior decor when they were building the new library. So, you know.
Like you say, looking at the decor and doing everything. And the Brimwell Jones Library, it's just such an astonishing building.
Yeah. I mean, I could have, obviously we were fortunate at the end of the conference to have a guided tour, and I could have stood and looked at the view for ages.
Did you go up to the viewing platform upstairs?
Can just make out the Humber Bridge, for example. It was really spectacular. I've always been rather proud that we don't have many celebrity librarians, so it's quite something that's always appealed to me.
What did you think about David Contick's comment that being a librarian is a bit like being a lighthouse keeper? It's a job where you can tell people to shop and go away.
That did appeal to me. Although, like libraries nowadays, we tend to be much more about mixed zones, where we do have silent zones as well, but there's so much group study and group projects now that you have to allow students to talk. So that they're not quite the sort of silent cathedrals that they used to be. But
I know. I remember reading about when Larkin was a librarian in Leicester, the front desk, before you actually went into the reading rooms, I think the front desk was a little bit of a centre of meeting and gossip.
Yeah, I think Monica Jones used to sort of perch on the edge of it, chatting to. Yes, I can imagine that.
So how did you find the conference?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, I'd been kicking myself for missing the 2022 conference, and I was determined to go along this time. And I hadn't really known what to expect, so I went with an open mind and a sense of adventure. But I just really had a completely absorbing couple of days. And I think it was just particularly the creative and inventive responses to his work and his life. I mean, we had music, obviously. Mm. Poetry, which of course, drama, visual arts with the discussion of Larkin's doodles, and as well as more sort of kind of academic in-depth analysis as well. So there was just constantly something to stimulate, and I think it was all threaded through with a keen sense of humour and kind of lively discussion as well. And not Larkin does have a complex legacy, but that, you know, we didn't need to be defensive, but at the same time, nothing was swept under the carpet. You know, everything was considered. And obviously David Quantick did the keynote opening, which was so funny and brilliantly delivered with comic timing, and it's always a little bit worrying. You think, oh gosh, is the rest of the conference going to live up to that? And it really did. I mean, every session in a different way really interested me. So,
oh, that's so good to hear. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying about David Quantick just miraculously setting the right tone for us. Have you watched it back on YouTube yet?
I haven't watched that one, no, but I will do. Yes, yeah, because I was trying to explain it to some people, but I just couldn't deliver the lines in the same way that he did.
No, it was really nice to watch back. I sat with my husband and said, oh look, come on, let's watch this. But there's going to be quite a lot of the talks, I think, on there, and hopefully they'll be great. Yeah, good for people to have a look at, people that weren't able to come along, or people that just wanted to watch it again. Yeah,
one of the talks I found particularly interesting was the Adam Lomax talking about Britpop and Larkin, because I used to be quite a Britpop fan as well, and I've got to say, I hadn't really thought about the kind of resonance with Larkin, but he really got me thinking that, you know, a lot of the songwriters and the bands I like, I mean, people like Jarvis Cocker, obviously, Damon Albarn, and before then I used to really like Andy Partridge from XTC, Paul Weller from The Jam, and I was thinking they've all got something of that Larkin quality, sort of commenting on the mundanity, the disappointment of English provincial life, and I think English rather than British, but also as well the occasional beauty, and that really got me thinking.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I like those kinds of very English bands. I agree with that sense of Englishness, and I was talking to Daniel Vincey, co-organiser, who's currently doing a PhD, an English PhD around the sort of post-war English university, and he's in his 20s, but he was telling me he's a big fan of the Kinks, which you don't hear much from people in their 20s.
Yeah.
I thought, yeah, very much, again, Larkin-esque, aren't they, that sort of beauty in the mundane and the everyday. I really liked Adam's presentation, just the use of imagery.
One of his slides was, I had a sort of Proustian rush when I saw it. It was the cover of the the anthology, Nine Modern Poets by Yale Black, because I studied that for O-level, and I'd been racking my brains because that was where I first encountered Larkin, kind of in the mid-80s when I was studying the O-level, and I was thinking, what was that anthology? And then suddenly there it was on the screen, and I thought, oh, yes, I remember.
Exactly the same thing happened to me, because I have actually got a copy of that, because I studied that in the 80s. We didn't do much Larkin, but we did some of the other writers in there. And I bought myself a copy of that from a charity shop a couple of years ago, because that cover is very striking. And very memorable. And if you spent a few years in the mid 80s, I think we did Yeats from it. I don't think we did Larkin. It's a really nice book to go back to. I'd recommend and go and read the introduction to the writers. And
yes, I'll look at
really good. kind of in the back of my mind thinking about doing a podcast around that book and the choices of the Larkin poems and E.L. Black's introduction to Larkin. Because obviously Larkin was, you know, still alive when he wrote that, and it was before the publication of the letters and the biographies, and a very different context.
I remember, I think we certainly did some Larkin and some Ted Hughes, and I must admit, I'm afraid, as a teenager, I found the Ted Hughes rather boring, and the Larkin sort of appealed to me much more. I've always been a, you know, kind of urban, suburban person, and I could relate to him writing about, you know, shops and houses and train journeys and workplaces and pubs, rather than anything more sort of esoteric, you know, nature, mythology, etc. But I think, although in later years, I think I have come to appreciate some of the beauty of Larkin's writing about nature. But at the time, that appealed to me much, much more. Because we then did the Wits and Weddings for, that was on the A-level syllabus. So that's when I really sort of immersed myself in Larkin.
And if you just carried on reading Larkin.
Yes. And obviously, I suppose because I ended up working in academic libraries, I'd always had that that interest. But one thing that I did realise about the conference is I'd perhaps rather drifted away from Larkin. I suppose partly, you know, with the letters and the controversy, it just becomes a bit exhausting. But obviously, his centenary rejuvenated my interest, and certainly the conference has made me realise, I really need to go back to read, particularly High Windows, which I must say I wasn't so familiar with. But also, because I particularly liked the poets Mary McCollum and Chris Seward, as well as Blake Morrison, of course. And I was thinking, again, I'm out of touch with contemporary poetry, so it's kind of inspired me to find out more about that.
Yeah, Mary's conversation with Larkin was fantastic. It was so funny. And
I thought it was really well done and creative, because, you know, yes, there are difficulties when you consider Larkin's legacy, but I thought that was just an imaginative, you know, quite feisty way of dealing with it, you know, entertaining. I found that very, very appealing and humorous, of course, as well.
I mean, I think the conference, and I'm going to include in those in that term the pre-conference event with the Education Day for sixth form students, which I thought was a huge success. But the whole thing, I thought, exceeded all my expectations, mainly because it produced an atmosphere in which all kinds of participants could engage with the speakers and could engage with themselves socially, intellectually. The atmosphere of collaboration between attendees and presenters was extraordinary, something that I've not really met before in many years of academic conferences. And of course, it's not really an academic conference, pure and simple. It's you and I talked before whether you register to come to an event like this, which you would do in an academic conference, or whether you buy a ticket for it, which is what you would do with a show. And it just kind of treads that boundary, which I think is hugely beneficial and what makes the whole thing enjoyable. You're not going to a conference to absorb the latest academic insights into the minutiae of Larkin's poetry or even his life. You're going there to have a genuine experience across the arts, with the, whether it be delivered by a paper, by a poet, by an actor, by a musician. It was wonderful. So it treads this boundary between academic conference and performance in a way which I think is a great credit to yourself, Lynn, because it's not an obvious mixture and it works brilliantly.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I had a couple of thoughts about that. I mean, first of all, as you know, I'm not an academic, so and I kind of fell into running the conference because, it, you know, when we went back to Kyra, who first proposed and started us down this route of reviving the academic conferences, she wasn't, and it, you know, she was an academic. And then when she moved on to other things and I took over, well, then you were putting it to the hand, into the hands of a non-academic at that point. So it was going to change directions, I think. But I also thought the variety of contributors, it's a bit like About Larkin, isn't it? Because About Larkin is also not a purely academic journal. It's a little bit how we approach About Larkin, where you can have the academic, but also you can have the much more personal and interpretations and reflections and even creative responses as well.
Well, I agree absolutely with that, and it just doesn't mirror About Larkin. It mirrors our old communications across social media, where you're not dealing with academics and teachers, valuable though they are. You're dealing with poetry lovers. And poetry lovers, one of the great joys of their existence is that they come from everywhere. And that's self-evident in social media. So I think the conference kind of picked up on that, the kind of universality of appeal of Larkin. And it would be wrong of the society, I think, to go back, I suppose, to the earlier days. It was important in those early days, I'm not denying that, where there was a strong emphasis on research and scholars writing on Larkin and PhD students producing their theses on Larkin, because that's just a stage in the journey, and you can understand that after his death and in the 1990s there's so much more material coming available and an assessment of his position and so on. But we've gone beyond that. I mean, Larkin has become a part of the idiom of a much broader population. And I think that was what was great about the conference, to recognise that.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned the day that we had with the sixth form students and the college students on the Wednesday. Maybe not many people will have been aware of that because we were mainly approaching schools and colleges to take part. But it really was such a fantastic day with about, do you want to say, about 40 students?
Yeah.
From four different schools and colleges across the whole area who, well, you know, they worked so hard all day long, didn't they? They just contributed and listened and asked questions and...
I think their level of concentration, I mean, I joined about a third of the way through, I suppose. But then, you know, it still had two or three, 4 hours to go. And it never wavered, really.
No.
And extraordinary and an absolute delight, of course, because they come uncluttered by and large, you know, with... any other agenda. They were just looking at the poetry and at the text. And I thought the teachers were terrific as well. You know, they kind of, you can see why they brought their students. They were passionate about the poetry.
Yeah, yeah. And it's as a former secondary school teacher, myself, English teacher, it is brilliant to be able to go into a room with some of your students and talk to people that aren't actually other secondary school teachers, but have the same like passion and knowledge about the subject, and just have that lovely forum for the whole day. And also the creativity was fantastic. I mean, the students, some of them shared some very personal stories and feelings that you know, this was the work that Vicky Foster did with them, using The Explosion by Philip Larkin as a starting point for their own writing, and she was getting them to think about incidents that they've witnessed or been part of. It didn't have to be anything as dramatic as obviously as the explosion in the poem, but something that was significant. And you know, some of them chose some really like serious turning points in their lives, or very interesting.
I've not seen those, but that's wonderful, isn't it? It's that creative angle of this war.
So,
well, of course, I couldn't help but reminded Lynn of the day I came to your school and talked to your students about Larkin, and I thought the one thing missing on the education day was your cake. I remember rightly, you iced it with a photograph of Larkin, and I took a slice of his left ear.
And that was actually all my students. They didn't tell me they were going to do that.
Oh,
they
was
just
it
went away and did it. Yeah, they just brought it in on the day.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah.
What a memory. Yeah.
So I hope we can do more work with young people of Hull and young people across the country, because clearly Larkin has a lot to say to young people.
And they come at it honestly. You know, they come at it without the baggage of academic weight on their shoulders saying he's a brilliant poet. But they also come at it without the weight of the biography.
Yeah.
About, you know, Larkin was the kind of most evil man of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And they look at it with a clear eye, which is hugely encouraging. Mm.
Yeah, it is. And we have our own narratives about Larkin, and it's really good to feel that you can pass that on to these 18, 19 year olds, and they will sort of see Larkin in their own way, won't they, in future generations, and hopefully, you know, continue to read Larkin and continue to celebrate his poetry and to share it with each other. And I got a sense from them that I think that will happen.
I think that's going to happen. I mean, I'm prejudiced, of course, but, you know, if you think of an 18-year-old in where we are now, 2024, 2025, what will they think of Betjeman or Masefield or even Auden? I think there's something about Larkin, as there is about Wilfred Owen, that kind of grabs you and is quite irresistible.
Yeah, and that mixture of everyday language and everyday events and the sublime and the far-reaching, they seem to get that.
Yeah, it's the most enjoyable conference I've ever been to, I have to say. And that's the word that keeps cropping up in discussions about it. You know, with people who come from all different angles. I mean, like the colleague from Newcastle, I think, Karen Carney, who'd come with a friend, and I'd not met her before, and her first words to me when I met her at the reception desk, as I was checking in, was the first words were, "I sent you an email in 2017, and I suddenly froze, thinking, "Oh goodness, I mustn't have answered it." You know, email 7 years out of date, but it wasn't that. she pulled out of her bag a folder and laid it out on the reception desk for me and reminded me that she'd emailed me back in 2017 saying that amongst her mother's papers, which she was, her mother was still alive, but she was in a nursing home. And she was concerned when she was in a nursing home that she'd lost a really important document to her. And it was a letter from Larkin to herself, her mother was a teacher. And as a teacher, she'd written, she'd plucked up courage to write to Larkin at the university library to say how much she enjoyed his poetry and expressed all sorts of admiration and insights and raised certain questions. And Larkin, as he always did, responded to genuine inquiries, not autograph hunters, but genuine inquiries, which he could tell a mile off. And Karen Carney, the name of the lady, said that a mother in the care home kept saying, "I've lost Larkin's letter." And kind of going through all her mother's effects, found it. And she contacted me and said that she found it. She sent me a photograph of Larkin's letter to her mother and saying how precious it was. And I asked the people, the wonderful people at the Hull History Centre, can you find the letter that Karen's mother sent that prompted Larkin's response? And they did. They found in the files a mother's letter, and handwritten letter, which I sent to her, saying, look, this is... Because she'd not got a copy of that, of course. She just had a handwritten letter, and that was it. So it kind of completed the correspondence. And she took this letter and, of course, the reply, which she'd by then found, to her mother in the care home. And she told me that it really meant everything to her mother, this exchange with Larkin.
Yeah.
And it was something that she was keen to be reminded of with every visit. And then not too long after, within a couple of years, I think she passed away. So there's a huge amount of emotional investment in this exchange. And Karen had come to the conference with her friend with this file, wanting to share it with people because it was so much a part of her life. And that's what I mean about, it's not an academic conference. It's a conference which kind of embraced all aspects of what poetry can bring to people. It's own creativity, its emotional charge, and the personal history. I thought was that, I mean, it happened within the first 5 minutes of my getting there.
Yeah.
And I thought it was kind of, wow.
Yeah.
It kind of encapsulated the whole brilliance of the conference and its uniqueness, I think.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful story. Absolutely beautiful. Because it just shows, yeah, like you say, the power of poetry and the kind of far-reaching effect of, you know, a communication with someone that means so much to you. With Larkin in that way.
Yeah.
I'd love to read those letters.
Yeah, no, well, we can certainly find them. I mean, on the conference meal, the informal conference meal in the pub.
Yeah.
Karen, I was sitting at the same table as Karen, and I invited her to tell that story.
Yeah.
And everybody who listened to it was completely wrapped up in it, completely overwhelmed,
yeah,
and understood the emotion,
yeah,
It was brilliant.
Oh, that's amazing. That's brilliant. There were so many lovely moments. One moment that stuck in my mind was after David Quantick's talk, everybody went off to get a cup of coffee, apart from James Booth, who went up to David Quantick and swapped email addresses. Well, which I thought was brilliant.
Well, I think that's, I mean, I James was horrific throughout the whole conference. And
yeah,
I mean, I said to him afterwards, you must have been absolutely delighted to find somebody who shares your view of the importance of Brunette Coleman.
Yeah.
Because that was, James has fought, you know, for a couple of decades now to try and promote the real importance of the Brunette Coleman.
Yeah, well, Brunette Coleman is what brought David Quantick to being an HVP, because when he tweeted about Brunette Coleman, and I don't know whether it was maybe Phil Pullen that had picked up on it, and that's when I contacted David Quantick.
Right.
So I thought, well, you're not tweeting about Brunette Coleman with just a passing interest. It's quite specialised sort of area of Larkin, isn't it, really?
It is, yeah.
It's not general readership. This man clearly knows, you know, what he's talking about and has taken a real interest here. And I'm really glad that he did mention Brunette Coleman in the talk, because obviously that wasn't particularly the focus of his talk. And yeah, I know that meant a lot to James.
But he's essentially right that it's very funny.
Yeah.
Everything, I mean, when I read Brunette Coleman's Introduction to Sugar and Spice, it, you know, what are we writing for?
Yeah, like yeah.
It curled me up. I thought, that's so amazing, and double levels of irony. And
it's absolutely brilliant. And I hadn't read that until I spoke to David Quantick for the podcast. So it was David Quantick that actually nudged me to go away and read these things, it is absolutely brilliant. That essay is a real surprise when you don't know much about what Brunette Coleman was doing, and you read that and you think, yeah, this is a very sophisticated piece of writing, very funny. Yeah. So it was lovely that, and lovely to see, Carol Collinson just talking to people, because people come along, and I think people obviously know Carol from the years and years of being membership secretary and events secretary, and they know James from all his amazing research and being the editor of About Larkin. And so they are our celebrities in lots of ways. And I could see people going up and talking to them, being really thrilled to speak to them and say hello and find out how they are. And I sat with them for most of the 2 days, and they got so much attention.
I noticed it, you know, from afar, because I was sat at the back, and it was an absolute joy, because they are stars, and they got so much to bring, and it was great to see them so embraced, I think, by all the conference goers, and that's the way it should stay.
Thank you so much to all my guests, and I apologise for the lack of poetry in this episode, but we really wanted to mark the conference, as it was such an amazing event for us. Please keep your calendar free for the middle of March 2026 for the next one. Our next actual get-together is the Society AGM, which takes place in Oxford on Saturday, June the 8th at the Bodleian Library. The day begins with refreshments at 11:30, and the formal AGM starts at 12, after which there will be a buffet lunch and talk by Dr. Christopher Fletcher, Keeper of Special Collections at the Bodleian and a Philip Larkin Society trustee. The PLS Events Group is planning lots more for later in the year, so if you want to keep informed, then please sign up to the mailing list at our website, or of course, become a member. I also wanted to add a big thanks to Wes Finch and the Mechanicals for coming up to Hull and playing us out on the Thursday afternoon. It was just so lovely to hear the Horns of the Morning live, and looking around at the attendees, I could just see how much they were enjoying the music. This podcast was produced by me, Lynn Lockwood, and Gavin Hogg, and the music was The Horns of the Morning by The Mechanicals Band. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future topics, then please, as ever, do get in touch.
Of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the coldest of dew. The dawn reassembles.